Moving now to agenda paper 3, IFRS 11, interaction with 16, and handing over to Nicolette.
Thank you, Sue, and good morning to the committee members. Agenda paper 3 addresses the recognition of lease liabilities by a party to an unincorporated joint operation when applying IFRS 11. Specifically, the request asked whether the lead operator recognises the entire lease liability or only its share of that liability for the fact pattern described in paragraph 5 of the paper. The request referred to a lease liability. However, the question could apply to any contract entered into by the lead operator that gives rise to a liability. Our analysis is outlined in paragraphs 10 to 44 of the paper, while paragraphs 45 to 50 summarise our conclusions. Paragraph 20B of IFRS 11 requires a joint operator to recognise both liabilities as it has incurred and its share of any liabilities incurred jointly. Identifying these liabilities depends on the terms and conditions of the overall contractual arrangements and agreements relating to the joint operation, including the laws pertaining to those contracts. Based on our analysis, we think that a joint operator's liabilities include those for which it has a primary responsibility. The tentative agenda decision focuses on the question asked, which was about the recognition of liabilities. For completeness of our analysis, in the staff paper, we considered all the relevant rights and obligations of the lead operator and the other joint operators in the arrangement. In this particular fact pattern, we concluded that the lead operator subleases the asset to the joint operation. I would now like to draw your attention to question 1 on page 17 and ask if you agree with our analysis and conclusion on this matter outlined in paragraphs 16 to 50 of the paper.
And so just to emphasise, the question that's come in is asked very specifically about the accounting for the liabilities by the lead operator. So if I can encourage the committee to focus on that as the primary question. Obviously, the staff analysed other aspects in the paper, but I think it's helpful to focus on the main question that came in that we've been asked to deal with, if I could request that. Reinhardt?
This is obviously a very difficult question, and there are varying views on this question. My own personal view is I would have come to a different conclusion than the staff analysis, and the reason for that is that when I step back and look at the arrangement, what I'm familiar with is, let's say, in an instance where you have a lead operator and you are and the joint arrangement is entering into a lease of a major piece of equipment, the lead operator would be working together with the other operators through the governance structure, again, through because it's a joint operation, in terms of the details of the lease, the pricing, et cetera. And so the lead operator is effectively, in my the way I look at it, entering into the lease on behalf of the joint operation, which is very consistent with the wording in IFRS 16, B11, which says that we should look at, in those instances where there's a contract to receive or goods or services on behalf of that may be entered on behalf of the joint arrangement, which is what I would see the fact here. And therefore, IFRS 16 says you look to the joint arrangement as being the customer. And so in that, because of that, I would say, given the application of IFRS 11, that the lead operator would show its share of the lease liability and the other operators would show their share of the lease liability. What troubles me is this is an example of where the lead operator enters into a lease, and the staff analysis would say the lead operator is the only entity that shows the right of use asset and the lease liability, whereas the other operators effectively show an obligation to the lead operator and an investment in the sublease. If the facts were that the lead operator purchased the equipment for a loan, that analysis would then suggest that the lead operator would show that piece of equipment as its asset and a bank loan, but the other operators would not show equipment. They would show perhaps, under the staff analysis, a investment of the lease and a lease liability, which is, I think, very different from what many people would see in a joint operation situation. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is in terms of the sublease, the papers suggest there's a sublease between the lead operator and the other operators. And I'm not entirely convinced that there is a sublease because the other operators don't have control of that asset. It's the joint control through the joint arrangement that exists. And I'm aware that there is some diversity in views out there where some people are quite happy in practice to date in their analysis to show the lead operator with 100% of the liability, but then go the next step to say there is no sublease, so I as the other operator, have nothing on my balance sheet other than when costs are incurred by the lead operator and billed to me, I recognize the liability at that point. I'm troubled with that aspect of the analysis. And so, as I say, my own perspective in terms of looking through IFRS 16, the substance of the arrangement, looking at it from the perspective of IFRS 11, I would have come to the view that the various participants would show the right of use asset and a lease liability in reflection of their interest in the joint operation.
Can I ask you something, Reinhardt, and sort of just pivot slightly? So the question we've been asked is focusing specifically on what the lead operator recognises in terms of its liability, given that it was the party that signed the lease. And my understanding is, as a matter of law, has primary responsibility as against the lessor for the payments under that lease. And just ask you how you'd respond to the fact that typically in our literature, thinking of IFRS 9, for example, under the derecognition requirements, which also apply to IFRS 16, it's scoped in for derecognition under IFRS 9, where it's very clear that what matters there for liability recognition is who is primarily responsible for something and the recognition of liabilities for which you're primarily responsible. So how would you reconcile that?
So I think, as I say, from the perspective of the arrangement itself, all of the joint operators, as the paper suggests, are jointly and severally responsible for that liability. And so in my view, that applying the principles of IFRS 11 would suggest each one should reflect their share of the liability. I don't see it so much as the recognition of a liability situation. It's who's responsible for what piece. Yes, the lead operator signs the lease agreement, but that is only because all the other operators have agreed. IFRS 16B11 says we look at this as a collective. And so in terms of who's responsible within that collective, it's a proportionate share.
But they did sign.
May I answer your question, Sue?
Sure.
May I try to answer your question?
Because I totally agree with Reinhardt's comments. Maybe I will develop that later on, not necessarily just after that. But to answer your question, You have two contracts there. So there is a lease contract signed effectively by the lead operator, and there is a joint arrangement. The lead operator would have never entered into the lease contract if there had was no joint operation arrangement. So legally, and you recognize that with the sublease analysis. So legally, effectively, its legal obligation is share of the lease liability and not the 100% of the lease liability. It's because he has just formally to sign the contract because there is no legal entity existing that can sign the contract. So one of the operator has to sign the contract because the joint operation is not a legal person and has not the ability to sign the contract itself. So hence, effectively, the lead operator signs formally the contract on behalf of the joint operation, and he would have never entered into this contract as such if there had no joint operation arrangement existing, and if he wouldn't know that the others would take their share of the lease liability. And I would say the combination of the two then leads to, the way I see it, same as Reinhardt, to him, to the lead operator accounting for each share only.
I think we have to be just a little bit cautious, though, saying I only signed the contract because I know I've got this other arrangement, because signing that contract creates, I think, real legal obligations, and we all know that in the normal course the expectation is that everybody shares in the cash flows and it's that group of cash flows that go to the lessor. But I think we need to be careful to analyse what the legal position is, which, as I understand it, based on the analysis in the paper, is that in the lessor, and I want then
the joint operation is also a legal obligation.
It is, but as a matter of what I think we need.
There is also a contract there. It's also a legal representation of the respective rights and obligations of the parties within the joint operation. So, totally understand the fact that there is one legal obligation which is taken by the lead operator, because it is the operator that signs the lease contract. But there is also another legal obligation, which is the joint operation arrangement, and which establishes the fact that the lease obligation is to be shared among participants to the joint arrangements. And it's just for a kind of formal technical reason that the lead operator enters into the lease contract. Otherwise, if the joint operation arrangement had been an entity, it's this entity would have entered into the lease contract. And then you would end up recognizing the two totally differently.
I know, but it's a different legal position, and I think we need to
be...
But our liability accounting is based on legal obligations, and that's what I think we need
to
be careful of.
You have two legal obligations.
Yes, we do.
Two legal obligations.
Sorry, we'll stop talking and I'll hand over.
Maybe I'll just draw out what I think the discussion is, only to say then if other committee members, when they come in, want to comment on that. Because I think we agree, our whole analysis in the paper agrees, we're trying to look at all of the contractual rights and obligations, contractual legal, whatever you want to call it, because that's very much the basis of IFRS 11. You have to recognise in joint operations your rights and your obligations. I think that Reinhardt and Bertrand, what you're saying is you come along and you say, because of the joint operating agreement, you're going to say, in effect, that kind of comes along and takes over and means that the lead operator only has to pay its share of the overall lease liability because the other operators have contractually committed and agreed to pay their share. However, I think that what our analysis tries to reflect is say, and what seems to come across other parts of our literature, is that actually by law, by contract, whatever we call it, the joint operating agreement doesn't take away the fact that the lead operator is primarily responsible for making 100% of the payments to the lessor. So in our analysis, we absolutely think there are contractual rights and obligations being created by the joint operating agreement. It's just in our analysis we're trying to reflect actually those contractual and legal rights and obligations to say what's happened in the joint operating agreement has created new rights in a sense for the lead operator, but it hasn't come over and taken away its actual primary responsibility, because the joint operating agreement has just created almost an obligation between the parties to the joint operation, and it hasn't extended to the external SR. But I know, yes,
should stop talking.
Yes.
If I could just add just one thing, sorry to interrupt, and I won't be long. From the technical perspective, I think what Bertrand and I are saying, each individual operator does not have control of that asset. And B11 says to assess whether there's a lease, look at it as a collective. And B11 clearly says the joint arrangement is the customer. If the joint arrangement is the customer, then what are the rights and obligations of each of the participants in that arrangement relative to the fact that the arrangement is the customer? I think what we're arguing is, based on that analysis, it's proportionate. But I just wanted to clarify.
And I guess the counterpoint made in the paper is that the insertion of that paragraph was really for the definition of a lease purpose. But, Bob?
I agree with staff think your analysis is
spot on. I agree with the points between and Sue you've made. I think over time we've got to be consistent. I see the principles in this is very similar to a situation we assessed in 2016 on a service concession where the operator was leasing some equipment on behalf of a grantor. And we said in that case that, no, you can't look through, this. Some people would deem the substance. It was looking at the legal obligation. The operator has the legal obligation to the lessor. Therefore, it must record the entire amount. And the fact that it's got an arrangement with the grantor does not extinguish any portion of its liability. I see the same principles here. If this was an arrangement where the lease was entered into joint and severally by all of the operators, then I think B11 applies. And then I think, yes, we get a different answer where each person puts on their portion of the lease. But this is not one of those. This is the one operator has legally obligated itself for the entire lease, and then it has a separate arrangement with the joint operation.
Jim?
I agree with the staff analysis. The reason behind it is exactly as Katrina and Bob just mentioned. There are two different contracts toward different parties. Particularly to the lead operator is signed such contract with the lessor to establish a lease, and so the lead operator has 100% of the liability. On the other hand, the joint arrangement gives the lead operator the right to recover or to reclaim partial of this liability from all the other parties. So the two-step treatment, I think, is appropriate.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm not very good at noticing who's put their cards up when. Bonnie.
I think the crux of the issue is whether we follow the legal form strictly or if we look at the substance of the transaction, because to me, if you look strictly at the legal, you get a different answer if the joint operation is incorporated versus unincorporated. And I guess I had always maybe looked at IFRS 11 as not coming to that conclusion. And so I think that's where I struggled a little bit with the staff analysis. And I think that's the point that Bertrand and Reinhardt are making is, in if you have an unincorporated joint arrangement, then someone has to enter into the lease agreement. So if that's the operator who has, for whatever reason, been deemed as kind of the lead, then they are operating on behalf of the other entities to the joint arrangement. And does it make sense that you get to a different answer if it's an incorporated joint operation and the joint operation enters into the lease on its own, or in this particular situation where the operator is entering into the lease on behalf? I take your point on the legal substance of the arrangement, and if you look at it just from a legal point of view, I do think that's the answer you get to. I think the question is that what IFRS 11 was intended to do in this particular set of circumstances or not? I have a lot of sympathy to the view that Bertrand and Reinhardt have articulated. I think I'm aware of a firm that has come out with a publication that walks through, which also makes a lot of sense to me in terms of these specific arrangements. So I'm struggling a bit because I can see both views. I understood the principle of IFRS 11 to lead to a different answer. If you look at it pure from a legal perspective, I think you get the answer that the staff got to. So I'm not convinced it is clear in the guidance. So I don't think that we can, I know I'm probably skipping ahead, but I don't think that we can issue an agenda decision that says it is clear, because I don't think it is.
Thank you. Bruce?
Thanks. I agree with the staff's analysis on this, and I'll give you my thinking for why I do. To start off with, to me, this is a conflict between the law, the accounting, and for want of a better word, what feels right. in terms of what I think should be happening. Legally, and I mean, I'll caveat that again to say, I mean, I think in any of these circumstances, we'd very heavily have to state that the law is going to be differently applicable. So we need to be accepting of that. The second one is, to me, when I read 20B in terms of what IFRS 11 says, I don't think it's ambiguous. It says to me the joint operator will recognize its liabilities. Now, my problem is when I have to look at the definition of a liability, if I'm the guy who signed the contract to put my name on it and take that overall responsibility for it, that's a liability. It doesn't matter where I want to look in the standards. I've got to recognize that liability. It then goes on and says, including its share of any liabilities incurred jointly. Well, this wasn't incurred jointly. I incurred it myself. So I have a lot of sympathy for the position that you're right, this happened because we've got an unincorporated entity. But just to Bonnie's point earlier, sure, I'm trying to remember back. We did all those agenda decisions on, remember the IFRS 11 stuff back many moons ago.
Yep.
Feeling old suddenly. Many moons ago. We did come to different answers. And I mean, I think we came to the realization when you're looking at rights and obligations, if you're in an incorporated entity or in an unincorporated entity, you do get a different answer. Yep. Because your rights and obligations
change.
Absolutely. They are completely different. I have a legal entity that gives me certain rights and obligations that I don't have when I've got an unincorporated entity. So I think, to me, I have to accept that whether you're right, it all feeds to substance is irrelevant. But maybe that is the substance, but the reality is we do get completely different answers when we've done that. In the fact pattern given to us, they've elected not to have a separate entity. And I think by having that election, there are rights and obligations legally that they've foregone. Which means you're now back to the situation of saying, as a joint operator, if I've signed it, I have to do that. So I think the first question I always say to myself is, legally, who has signed this? And I think the reality is, if I've signed it as the lead operator on this, I've got a legal obligation. I can't get rid of that. And I meet that definition. In terms of the legals, I think the other thing we'd need to always look at is the control around that asset, because, I mean, that's where IFRS 16 is leading us to as well. If we've come to the conclusion there's a lease somewhere along the line, we've got to have a conclusion, we control it. We can't say, well, we all control it, because then I'm going to start jumping into that circular argument. Well, if I don't control the asset or the use over the asset, do I really have a lease? And so I think there's a step there that we'd have to assess, that we're assessing we have that control. Because if we don't assess that, then we can't have a lease in terms of what IFRS 16 is telling us. As to the third element, where we're talking about, yes, the other guys are on the hook if something goes wrong. To me, yes, so I've got, whether I want to call it a financial guarantee, whether they've collateral, whatever they've done, there's that second agreement that says somewhere along the line somebody's come and said, yes, if there's a problem, we'll do that. Fine, we'll deal with that as a separate agreement, but I don't think it necessarily mitigates what I've got in terms of IFRS 11. Just one comment, I just want to pick up on something Petrina said earlier, which was talking about the cash flows. I'm not that fazed as to who pays the cash flows. I mean, I don't care if one of the other operators pays the lease. That's irrelevant to me. This has to come down to, do I have a liability as defined? And if I've got a liability as defined, I need to recognize it. But I do have a lot of sympathy that the answer probably doesn't necessarily reflect what I'd like it to be, but it's where I'd get to in terms of the standard.
Guy?
I have approached this in my mind in more of a legal context, similar to the way the staff has analyzed this issue. Taking that legal approach, I think there are some more questions to be asked about the sublease issue, but I'll park that for a minute. Having said that, and well, maybe I'll reiterate, I think what others have said. I think 20B of IFRS 11, paragraph 21 of IFRS 11, those really do seem to direct you down the path that the staff has taken in the analysis. But, I think it's also important to come back to IFRS 16 B11 and really try and parse what B11 is saying, because, I think some could point to that as a source of some confusion around this issue. The first part of B11 is a statement that isn't tied to a lease arrangement or not. It's just saying a contract to receive goods or services may be entered into by a joint arrangement or on behalf of a joint arrangement. In this case, the joint arrangement is considered to be the customer in the contract. In BC 126, the first part of BC 126, which isn't quoted in the paper, elaborates on behalf of a joint arrangement, and I think it says it might be signed by one or more of the parties to the joint arrangement on behalf of the joint arrangement. So I think it comes down to what does that phrase mean, or on behalf of the joint arrangement? Is that a legal phrase, or is that something associated with how the joint arrangement is governed? And so it was the decision to enter into that contract subject to the governance of the joint arrangement. And so that means it's on behalf of the joint arrangement. Or is it a question of legality as to who's the primary obligor in that? Is the signatory signing as primary obligor, so it's not on behalf of the joint arrangement? Or is the signatory causing, as nominee or something like that, causing each of the operators to be jointly and severally liable to the lessor through that signature? To suggest it's other than that legal type view, I think runs the risk of creating some conflict with aspects of IFRS 11, paragraph 20B, and the like. And so my own inkling is to read that as supportive of the way the staff have analyzed the issue. That being said, I could see some ambiguity in that comment or in that paragraph in terms of how some may have chosen to read it.
Okay, thank you. Tony?
Yeah, I'm in a very similar place. I agree with the staff's analysis as far as the accounting for the liability by the lead operator is concerned. I think it's important to account for the transaction that we're looking at, not for the transaction we might have had. So if it was an incorporated joint arrangement and it signed the lease, it would be different. If, as Guy said, the lead operator signed it legally on behalf of and created joint and several primary responsibility for the lease, maybe you get a different answer. But that's not the fact that we've got. The lead operator has the primary responsibility to the lessor. It's entitled to a reimbursement of its costs or cash flows from the other operators, but that has not given the other operators primary responsibility for the lease obligation. So I think we have to account for the transaction we have, and paragraph 20B of IFRS 11 says that the operator accounts for its obligations together with its share of any obligations accounted for jointly or assumed jointly, and there isn't anything that's assumed jointly in this case. So I think that certainly as far as accounting for the liability is concerned, I agree with where the staff got to. I think, like Guy, there are some more questions around whether there's sublease or not. Mm-hmm. But as far as the lease liability is concerned, I agree with the staff.
Okay, thank you. Carl?
Yes, I also agree with staff's analysis. Actually, I think it's a very comprehensive analysis, very good paper, very helpful in terms of identifying how to articulate the primary responsibility approach. So I agree with staff's analysis.
Thank you.
I think this is a very good paper and another benchmark for me in terms of quality of analysis. Okay.
Come, let's go on. Young Su?
Yeah, I think I am in favor of Reinhardt than the staff. As everybody else says, this is an issue of whether we have to look into the legal issue or whether we have to look at the substance of the contract. And I think in this case, substance is more important than the legal form. If we look at only the legal issues, then we cannot but end up with the staff conclusion with the lead operator has to recognize the full amount of lease contract. But as Bartman said, the lease contract was not be able to made without joint operation agreement. So the first contract is the lease contract, and the second contract is the joint operation agreement. And what I meant is that the first contract was not be able to made without considering the second contract. I mean, lead operator would not make any contract of the lease if there is no the joint operation agreement. So if you look at only the legal obligations, the lead operator has to recognize the full amount of the lease liability. But if you think about the substance itself, I think that those two contracts are actually one in substance. So that is the first reason why I support actually the Reinhardt and also Buttrend. And the second reason why I think we have to look into the substance rather than the legal form is because of IFRS 11. What IFRS 11 says is that the joint operators has to recognize their own share of assets and liabilities, not their share of the net assets of the joint operation, which means to me that the IFRS 11 is more focused on the substance rather than the legal form.
Can I ask you a question, Yongsoo? So Bruce referred to the words which were analysed by the staff, which is the fact that IFRS 11, sorry to put you on the spot, but, says that a joint operator shall recognise its liabilities.
Its liabilities.
Including those.
Its share.
Its shares.
Of any liabilities incurred.
Its liabilities.
Yeah. But not the liabilities of the whole entire joint operation.
No, but it's signed the lease contract. So how do you... And so as far as the lessor's concerned, they can just pursue the lead operator. So how do you read the words in paragraph 20 in that context? I guess that's what we focused on.
Right. Maybe I have to reread it again.
Okay, sorry. I was just interested if you read the words differently.
I'll rethink about it.
Martin?
I agree with the staff analysis. I believe it's a very good paper. This lease asset is not accounted for as any other asset within a joint operation. And in general, you do not have this split of the assets in general. And on the other hand, I guess there would be no difference whether the lease contract would have been entered into before the joint operation was founded and then put into the joint operation. I believe a very good paper, and I'm supportive of it.
Thank you. And do you have your card up again, or was that from before?
No. It's because I answered your question, so I ended up at the end of what I wanted to say.
Oh, okay.
Not to come back in again. If I can go to the to the beginning. So, having read the paper, effectively, when you read it, and you've done the analysis, the staff that did the analysis the way it was, formally, I think you can. I can perfectly understand the conclusion that is reached within the paper. First comment. Second comment, I don't, in my corporation, when we establish a joint operation arrangement, generally it's incorporated. So there is an entity. So I don't have any practical experience of such arrangements. So maybe it will also ponder a bit what I'm about to say. And then, when I look at IFRS 11, I think it depends what you begin to look at first. If you begin to look at IFRS 16 first, then obviously you end up reaching the staff conclusion. But then if you consider IFRS 11 first, it's where you might end up having a different answer. And it is what Bonnie said earlier, because then you have a joint operation that is establishing the respective rights and obligations of the parties within the joint arrangement, whether incorporated or not, and then effectively one has to sign contracts. Maybe it's not always the same that is signing the contracts on behalf of the joint arrangement. So there is a lead operator, which is the one that is signing this specific lease contract, maybe as a lead operator is signing all contracts and is committing on behalf of the joint operation for the wood contract, but at the same time he's doing that because he knows that its obligations will be having signed the joint operation arrangement, limited or capped to its share of the... So your question to Jiangsu, I would say it depends on the unit of account you're considering, whether you consider just each contract separately or whether you you consider the two contracts as a combined. And if you consider the two contracts combined, there is no liabilities. Yeah, there is just share of liabilities.
And,
but I totally appreciate the analysis you that was done by the staff and the conclusion that was reached by the staff. It's just that then the outcome of this is odd, or seems odd, and some have alerted me on the fact that they felt it was really odd. And when you think of it, then effectively it's maybe like, I don't know if there is a conflict between IFRS 16 and IFRS 11, but there in this specific question asked, in this specific submission, if you look at IFRS 16 first, you come to the staff conclusion. If you look at IFRS 11 first, then you might end up with a different conclusion. It's quite striking.
And I think the point that you make is correct, that the analysis in the paper would very much get you to a different situation where the lead operator has entered into the lease directly and that it's got an arrangement to be have contributions made by the other joint operators. Completely different position to if they had all, for argument's sake, signed the contract and become jointly and severally liable. But that's in exactly the same way as in our standards. For example, if I was to borrow money and be guaranteed by Katrina, and she's very creditworthy, I would still have to recognise my liability, even though I have the benefit of her guarantee and support.
I agree with you, because of IFRS 9, and because effectively in IFRS 9 it's pretty clear that you would consider... for sure, assets and liabilities for each separate party.
It's not only IFRS 9, though. So, for example, in insurance, we recognise insurance contracts and reinsurance contracts because we look for primary obligations. And I think...
At the same time, there is respective scope exclusions between 9 and 16.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's in the scope.
So that's
I'm just saying as a... Using our definition of liabilities, that would be typically how we would think about it.
And I suppose I'd just add that for me as well, of course, you know, my automatic starting point is to look at IFRS 16 when I think about things. And given that this was, you know, about a lease contract, I also pick it up because, first of all, of course, leases are in IFRS 16, not in IFRS 9. However, they are financial liabilities. That's very clear. And the thinking that the board put into IFRS 16 in this respect, I think, is exactly the same as the IFRS 9 analysis and what Bob mentioned on service concessions. And I know we refer to it in the paper, but for me it came across very clearly in the board's decision-making about subleases. So even we had some responses back when developing IFRS 16 that said, look, I'm going to sit as the intermediate lessor. I don't want to use this leased asset. The only reason I'm going to enter into this lease from Sue, who's the owner, is because I already know Nicolette is going to lease this asset from me. And so I haven't entered into this for my own use. I've only, to your point, Eric, I've only entered into it because I know Nicolette's going to pay me, you know, quite a lot in terms of taking that asset. And in that case, even if it were the situation that Nicolette is going to pay me every penny that I'm going to pay to Sue, and even the timing of cash flows are lined up, the board still said in that situation, because my contract with the Nicolette does not take away or extinguish my primary responsibility to pay Sue as the owner, you treat those two as two separate contracts. So that one.
Patrina, I understand what I said. I understand this analysis. What I'm just saying is then when you have IFRS 11 on top of that, for an incorporated entity, there needs someone to sign contracts, and it cannot be the joint operation. So, because it's not an entity.
And we completely appreciate that. I think
And it's there where I have a difficulty of ending up with the position you've reached in the paper.
Andrew.
I
agree with a lot of what some people have said.
Yeah, we have no idea what your view is.
But perhaps to show which camp I'm in, I very much agree with the analysis in the staff paper, at least so far as the lead operator is concerned. I think there may be some questions around the sublease and exactly how that works, but that's a separate question. I think the issue is that there is a real difference in rights and obligations that arise depending on whether you have an incorporated or unincorporated joint operation. And that is because of where the primary obligation for liabilities will sit. Because as many people have said, if you have an unincorporated jail, it can't itself have a legal obligation. And so what you see in many jails where there's no entity is one of the operators will enter into all the contracts. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in practice is that that operator has 100% of the trade creditors, 100% of the loans, and a reimbursement right from other parties. And I don't personally see a lease contract as being any different from that. There's a very big difference between primary obligations and joint and several. Others have talked about that, so I won't dwell on that. There was a question about if there's a lease, how do you have control? If you're the lead operator, how do you have control of the asset because you know where it's going? I think I would rationalize that by saying, as the lead operator, I take out a lease for this asset and control the asset and decide to put it into the joint operation. And that's how I get control. That's how it's my asset. And then I decide what to do with it. In terms of the accounting that you get, it really comes down to the rights and obligations, because in this fact pattern, we've got reimbursement from the operators. You could have it that you have the lead operator with the lease and is then compensated with a disproportionate share coming out of the joint operation. You would then record the rights and obligations arising from that. The one thing that I wondered if the analysis and perhaps even the tentative agenda decision might focus on a bit more is to, we've got a bit about the derecognition of obligations. I think if we focused on the requirement to recognise, then that would help get us into the place that the staff are reaching, because by entering into this contract, regardless of how it's structured and regardless of where you start, I as the lead operator have 100% of an obligation. And therefore, contractually, I can be pursued for 100% of that amount. That's the obligation that I've got. Once I've got that obligation, it's pretty hard to de-recognize it. And perhaps if we went through the initial recognition part of the analysis, that then takes you into why you can't get it off your balance sheet. The other thing that is perhaps worth thinking about a little bit further is that you get a bit into offset here, because a number of people have said, well, the substance of what's happening is that you have your share. I think substantively, assuming everything goes well, that's what you've got. But if I go into IS 32, if I've got the primary obligation for something and I have a reimbursement right from something else, someone else, I'm not going to be able to offset those assets and liabilities. And for those who would like to show the net amount on balance sheet, I think that that's what we're trying to do. And I don't think I can get there under IS 32 or indeed under IS 1 where it's not covered by 32.
First of all, I support the staff analysis, and even from the non-technical financial statement user's point of view, I learned a lot from the paper that how the paragraphs of IFRS can be applied to solve this kind of difficult situation. And also, from the point of view of the users, it is crucially important that substance should be emphasized over legal form. And of course, if there is some kind of risks and obligation arising from the legal contract, that should be disclosed.
But as far as if we focus on the economic substance, I think that's the analysis and solution are very conceivable and persuasive. And also that from user's point of view, that this paper's paragraph 50, which is talking about the disclosure, that is crucially important. Yeah. You know, anyway, I believe it is very difficult for financial users to understand what this kind of transaction means to that the lead operators, just from that all this financial information. So that we have to look at the notes to find what kind of legal implication could have impact on the obligation and risks of the lead operators. Thank you.
Thank you, Gar. Bonnie.
So I wanted to ask a question just of those that supported the staff's conclusion. Maybe I'll ask the staff. If the contract in this particular example were a joint and several contract, lease agreement with whoever the lessor is and all of the joint operators, would you get to a different answer?
So, funny, yes, we would get to a different answer because then each of the joint operators has a responsibility for their portion of the lease liability. And generally in these lease contracts, the lawyers will be very specific as to what joint and several actually means and when it is applicable. So each joint operator will know what portion it is liable for when.
Which is a good question, because I think the whole analysis is very focused on the fact that, as a matter of law, the lead operator is on the hook, whether or not they receive from the joint operators, and then they have a right to recover, which is what the analysis is based on, which is different to the situation if everybody signed and the deal was everybody pays their 25%, and then you only step in for more if the others have failed, which is more like a primary obligation for 25% each and then a guarantee for the rest, which has got separate accounting requirements.
So I don't personally have experience with these types of transactions. I think based on what I've understood is common in at least the oil and gas industry is that commercially, I think the lessors probably understand the purpose of the contract and why there's one operator that's operating on behalf, and it's for a simplification reason rather than kind of the legal aspect. So one of, I guess, the things that I struggled with a bit is accounting driving commercial decisions, which I don't agree with, or is practice really that different that the accounting forces you to get to different answers? And does that make sense? Which I realize is not necessarily the intent of, the accounting is written the way the accounting is. I'm struggling a little bit with how it's so clear to some people and so not clear to others. And if there's, I think, a couple of different views, while I may be in the minority of those different views, I just struggle with saying that the guidance is clear, particularly for a new standard that's a couple of months away from being implemented. And I understand that this would drive change, which if this is driving change to what people are nearly done with their implementation, because if you're not nearly done by September, then you're going to have some issues. So I think we need to take care with how we're going to resolve this. And so that's why I was asking the question about the joint and several, because, if that creates the answer that is intended by these structures, then practically speaking, do entities have to go out and renegotiate all these lease agreements so that they are reflective of what the intent of these agreements are? In terms of when you have an unincorporated joint operation. Yeah, like I said, I don't have experience with this particular type of arrangement. I don't know how significant of an effort that would be for this particular industry, and maybe it's applicable to others. But I just think we need to take care with a standard that's, you know, nearly implemented.
And your warning is a good reminder. Hopefully we always take care. But you're right that given the timing, it's critical. On the flip side, though, the whole reason why we've got this question now and why we're told to deal with it ASAP was so that we can try, get some clarity to the market on a timely basis. So we need to think of those two different perspectives.
Understood.
When we ask the question, which we'll get to in a second. Tom?
As we hear different opinions about how to account for this, it might be interesting to know what is the view of the securities regulators. We discussed this also, and we came to the same conclusion as the staff did. We believe that the rights and obligations differ depending whether there is a incorporated entity or not.
Okay, that's useful to know. Mary, do you want the last word before I try and
although I'm going to put myself at some risk with you by what the last words are. I'm just going back
Think
to...
Think carefully about your last words before you say something.
Or they may be my last words.
You're far away, but not so far.
I was just actually, Bonnie, reflecting on your first comment rather than your most recent one about concern about clarity and whether we think the standard is so clear that an agenda decision can be reached. I think one nuance that we have to remember is that what we're saying is, you know, what the committee says if it decides to offer commentary is not that the standard is clear, but rather that there's sufficient guidance in the standard for resolving the question. That's one thing, and I think very often, and this is a comment I've made in discussions with securities regulators, I think that there's a lot of work and discussion that goes into developing the analyses that come to this committee. Mm-hmm. And so the discussion at the committee, a discussion like this one, is part of bringing understanding about how things work. Now, I shared, actually, I had a lot of empathy for your comment about not having worked with the standard a lot in the issues, and you pick it up and read it, and you can kind of read it a couple of different ways. But I thought two things that were particularly important to me as I read the staff analysis is in paper 15, the paragraph from the basis for conclusion that's cited includes the very last sentence about the economic substance depends on the rights and obligations assumed by the parties when carrying out such activities. And then at the end of paragraph 19, the staff's explanation of paragraph B18, when it says it's agreed share of any liabilities, that sentence was meant to refer to obligations that are created by the operating arrangement itself. And so this is the staff trying to basically take the spaghetti that's been dumped and sort it out. And so the staff has put this wording here, and I think a question for all the committee members, including those who came in and had read it differently, to say that they, I think it was Bertrand who said it kind of matters whether you start reading 11 and then you go to 16 or you look at 16 and then go to 11, that having done this analysis and worked through, is this persuasive in terms of telling you this is the sequencing in terms of how you read it, or do you not agree? And so that, I think, is in some ways the question that's being asked mm-hmm. after, if I dare call it, a robust discussion.
Yeah.
Bruce?
One quick comment. Sorry, I went all up. I was just going to say, I completely agree with what Mary is saying. I mean, just not that I'm jumping into the nitty-gritty of the agenda decision, but to me, that's what we're planning on, is liabilities under IFRS 11. And I know that we're all saying, well, this is such a big issue with leases, but in my mind, it actually was not as much an IFRS 16 issue as this is an IFRS 11.
Yeah, it's just been highlighted by 16.
Exactly.
Okay, so good discussion, I think, and I agree, a really interesting staff paper. So moving on now to questions 2 and 3. So we had a mix of views. So can I see a show of hands on whether the committee agrees with the staff's recommendation not to add the matter to the standard setting agenda?
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Okay. Then does anybody have any specific, some comments that they want to make in relation to the draft wording of the tentative agenda decision? Aye.
I think at this point, I wouldn't mind coming back to the sublease question to ensure the agenda decision isn't implying something in regard to that hasn't been sufficiently analyzed or debated.
Okay.
And, I think the agenda decision primarily focuses on the question of the lead operator's liabilities. And I read it in that manner until I get to the very end of the agenda decision. And in the very last sentence, we say the committee concluded that the requirements in existing IFRS standards provide an adequate basis for a joint operator to identify its liabilities. And I was wondering if that should refer to the lead operator.
From the joint arrangement as opposed to from the lease.
I mean, we could do this. Clearly, the question we were asked was about the lead operator. I think, at least we intentionally worded this way. I'll tell you why, and then you can decide whether you agree with that, which is that, of course, our analysis is very much focused on the lead operator, but I suppose my concern would be if we just said the lead operator recognises. You know, in reading IFRS 11, and in particular applying paragraph 20B of IFRS 11, we somehow distinguish and say it's only the lead operator that recognises its liabilities for which it has primary responsibility. Do we almost imply that the other joint operators could not recognise liabilities for which it has primary responsibility? And I think that's not, obviously, IFRS 11 is worded for all joint operators. Obviously, in this situation, we might think the lead operator's liabilities are different from the other operator's liabilities, but I would still think that the words of IFRS 11 are saying each joint operator recognises its liabilities. Now, in saying that, if people would rather focus on lead operator, we can narrow down the...
I think that's helpful. You're nodding, Bruce. What are you agreeing with?
I just think if we don't, I think it's a very good point. If we don't put lead in, we're just going to get questions about it. And I think we haven't really discussed the other joint operators' accounting, and I'd hate to imply that we have and we think it's obvious.
And we were quite careful to be specific in the discussion. So I sort of hear you, but I think it's fair that people might overread what we mean. Tony?
I had the same comment about lead operator. I also wondered in the paragraph, the third paragraph, the committee observed liabilities that a joint operator incurs. Are we talking about incurring liabilities or about recognising liabilities? I just wondered whether it ought to be recognising liabilities.
Yeah, paragraph 20 is...
Maybe we should tie closer to the words in 20.
We'll have a look at that. We were trying to flow through the logic of the paragraphs before, but... Yeah.
And I wondered about the last part of that sentence as well, and maybe just one for you to think about when you are thinking about it. Including liabilities for which it has a present obligation to make payments. I wasn't quite sure what that was saying. I get the bit about primary responsibility, but I wasn't quite sure what the rest of it... What additional point the rest of it makes?
We could start with primary responsibility.
That's okay. Okay. Bob?
So I was responding to the comment before about going, changing the wording from joint operator to lead operator. I was in favor of the way staff drafted it because I think what you were referring to there, joint operator is referring back to 20B, and which is in the context of all joint operators. I didn't think you were referring to, and we weren't getting into the, in this agenda decision, in the staff analysis, we did talk about subleases, but I didn't think this agenda decision was focused on that sublease issue.
I don't think it is either, so you don't share the concern that people could read those words more broadly than what we mean? That's, I think, what the point that's being raised.
I didn't read it that way. But I can't say how everybody's going to read it.
The benefit of putting it out for comments. So. Jennifer?
this is just more a specific wording comment, because once you pointed out that, for example, in the first paragraph of the agenda decision, it uses, you know, it refers to, you know, hereafter lead operator. I'm just rereading it quickly. I don't actually see thereafter where lead operator is used. So it's sort of defined and then not used. So
thank you.
Just reassess whether
that we need it. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Might depend on where they would end up. At the
yeah,
end.
Exactly.
Andrew.
Okay. Couple of things. On the, perhaps somewhere around the second paragraph, perhaps it might be possible to weave in the initial recognition points and then you apply de-recognition after that. On paragraph four, I thought perhaps we could make it slightly clearer if when we say that we observe the liabilities the joint operator incurs include the whole amount of those for which it has primary responsibility, just to be a little bit clearer on it. On the point in the last paragraph, I wasn't particularly troubled because I thought that the agenda decision had discussed in the second paragraph what a joint operator is required to do. We then talk about what the lead operator has to do for specific obligations, but that doesn't take away that we've already talked about what joint operators in general have to do.
Which was your design from a staff perspective? Guy, coming back in.
Sorry, I had one other comment. As I was saying earlier in my comments related to question one, I think one of the sources of ambiguity on this issue is the first part of paragraph B11 of IFRS 16 and what is meant by or on behalf of a joint arrangement, and this notion of legal versus under the governance of the joint operation itself. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the agenda decision should speak to that, to, you know, state how we're reading that phrase, because I do think that is one of the sources of ambiguity that has led to this question arising.
I think that's a bit hard to throw in there, though, because it wasn't really analysed or discussed in too much detail off the top of my head.
I mean, we could. Sorry, Bonnie, do you want to come in and then I'll
respond?
Yeah,
I do. I was debating if I was going to make that same point because it wasn't really analyzed in the paper, and I think that is part of where the confusion comes in and why perhaps this issue is coming up with I4S 16 because of how that is written. So I agree with you, Sue, but I think that is a relevant point.
Well, what we could do, just have a 2-second whisper with Petrina, is point out the basis link for B11, which explains why it was put in, which is the control point.
I think this is unclear, and that's what's driving the confusion.
But I suppose what we'd say, as I say, I agree that if you just had maybe read, you know, the opening words of B11 in isolation, but I suppose what we hopefully did in our analysis here, and what we think is very helpful, we're not making it up, it's in the basis. We think this is a situation where potentially the explanation in the basis provides helpful explanation that helps, you know, helps people when it's pointed out, tell you how to go about, you know, reading the words in B11, and at least what the basis paragraph, in my view, makes, you know, very clear that paragraph applies only in the context of assessing whether the contract contains a lease or not. And so if we think that is helpful, then we could simply, you know, quote the words of the basis as explaining how you go about reading the words.
I might try voting without it first, but we'll see in a second. Carl?
Yes, I'm comfortable with the wording. And my comment is just to emphasize the contrast with the previous agenda decision. I very much like this approach. It's a true principle-based approach, and I'm supportive of this in contrast with the previous one.
Okay, a couple of comments from board members, and then I will move on. So, Mary, I think you were up, had your card up first.
Okay. You had said at the very beginning, Sue, that you asked the committee of this issue to focus on the issue of liability recognition.
Yep.
By the lead operator.
Yep.
I think, though, some have also raised concern about by focusing in the agenda conclusion only on the obligation of the lead operator, that it, and I'm putting words into people's mouth, that it might leave others feeling that they get away scot-free, you know, in terms of having to, you know, the other operators, but you do not want to extend this to the sublease. Against that background, I was looking back at the wording. The end of the first paragraph says, the joint operator that signed the lease contract has the right to recover its share of costs. And then in the next to last paragraph, the reminder about disclosures does highlight the nature and effects of its contractual relationship with other investors in there. What is not raised and maybe could be added to the end of the second paragraph. So, you know, right now it says, accordingly, a joint operator and recognizes both A and B, is making the point that the A joint operator also has to consider obligations that arise from its contractual relationship of the joint arrangement itself. Not saying sublease, not saying anything else, but just the reminder that you're considering not only that you incur in relation, that it just is a reminder to think about whether the joint arrangement itself creates any obligations that you must consider. And that, I think, makes it more generic with respect to joint operators.
Okay. Gary.
Okay. Sort of the same point as a few others just raised. I'm not sure if I agree or disagree with Mary, so I'll just make the point. But it's on the last paragraph about to use joint operator or lead operator. My advice would be is to go with lead operator, and this might be more to my former life than current. And because first of all, the analysis was on the lead operator. Two is, if you think of this room's a little bit, you know, back and forth, what does it mean? What does the standard say? Well, there's a lot of people out there, like thousands, that are nowhere near as close to the stuff. And if you start saying joint operator, well, everyone's a joint operator. One happens to be the lead. I think the go-to person, you know, if you're the counterparty, the lessor, whoever else, is the person who signed the contract. And they signed it on their own rights, and the fact that they might have recourse or reinsurance or whatever from their partner who's in the joint arrangement, that's, I think, a separate issue called a sublease, wherever you want. But I don't even mind if we expand on this paragraph, you know, to lead operators, non-operators, you know, the partners, and even though maybe we don't want to, but I think it should be clear it's the lead operator is who the focal of this analysis was. It's the person with the singular obligation to the counterparty, and all the other joint arrangement things that might subsidize them or whatever, I think, is a separate issue.
Okay, thank you. Young Sue?
I just agree with the Gary that we have, maybe it's better to change the wording from joint operator to the lead operator, but if you look at the other parts of the joint decision, there is no mention about the lead operator. We didn't define what is lead operator in any earlier parts of the agenda decision. So maybe we have to say something about lead operator before we say we change the wording at the last paragraph of the agenda decision.
In paragraph one, though, we do say that it's the person who signed the lease.
What line is that?
At the third from the bottom of the first paragraph.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say that.
Which we're not using so far, as Jennifer pointed out, but if we wanted to, we may now use it. It's a moment of inspiration and forethought. Okay, so with that...
Just quick, one change that you could make to the final paragraph, which might, I guess, somewhere home, is to say that IFRS standards provide an adequate basis for a lead and other joint operators to identify their liabilities. And then you get to raise that there's a distinction to be made between the two, but also we mention the lead operator specifically.
I'd be nervous about
I'm
that.
I'm not sure I'm going to
probably
flow
through whatever we do.
I was in control of the world, maybe, but I'm not. So what I will ask for a show of hands on is, so do you have specific changes, first of all, that you're planning to make? And then
I think what I heard is in particular, so we're on page 19, the draft agenda decision, 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph, the short one. What I heard and what we were supposed to change that to say is the committee observed that the liabilities that a joint stroke lead, to be discussed maybe, joint or lead operator, So observe that the liabilities that a joint operator recognises include those for which it has primary responsibility.
Full stop.
Full stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The deregulation point. You're not gonna... Okay. So that was the change proposed by the staff. I think I'll take a show of hands, assuming that we restrict the last paragraph to refer to the lead operator, because I think more people are comfortable limiting it to that. And I propose not adding in B11 at the moment. If we can, I hear you, but I'm just worried about stretching beyond what we discussed. So can I get a show of hands for the tentative agenda decision on that basis, please?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
OK, so I think we have a well-earned break.